I think we might kick off. Welcome to Further Adventures in Health Risk, an updated history of Australian health insurance. This is a sequel paper by Andrew Gale from a paper he wrote 10 years ago with David Watson. Andrew Gale is an actuary with over 20 years experience in the Australian health insurance industry. He currently provides actuary advice as an independent consultant. He has previously held chief actuary roles for Medibank Private and AXA Health Insurance, which is now Bupa, where he was responsible for the appointed actuary functions and providing actuarial advice to the board and management. He has published many papers on health insurance and presented extensively on numerous PHI topics, including historical trends and developments, community ratings, demutualizations, and claim selection effects. He also presents health lectures to actuarial students at the Melbourne University and the Australian Institute, Actuaries Institute CAP course. So Andrew's going to have a quick chat, and then there'll be time for discussion at the end. When you do have comments, please go to the microphone, speak clearly, state your name and where you're from, and be mindful of the feedback forms on your app or written submissions. I'll hand over to Andrew now.
Great, thanks, Ben. Hopefully you've had a chance to download the paper and have a read, but I will try and give a bit of a brief overview, but then I'd love to have quite a bit of time for questions, and I'm not going to be answering all your questions. Hope you're going to have a good discussion amongst the people in the room, because that's really one of the reasons I wrote the paper, just so we could get together and have a bit of a chat about private health insurance. I think that's always a great thing to do at a summit like this. So, yeah, as the theme of the summit is Think Differently, the 2017 summit. But the theme of the 2007 biennial convention, for those that were there, was Adventures in Risk. And so it was in 2007 that David Watson and I decided we'd write a paper called Adventures in Health Risk to leverage off the convention topic and a history of Australian private health insurance. So with a decade passing, I thought we couldn't lose the opportunity to do an update. And thinking about the last 10 years, there's certainly been a lot of things happen in private health insurance that many of you would know about. Perhaps before I get onto that, adventure. I looked up my dictionary. What does adventure mean? An unusual and exciting or daring experience. Now, some people like to tell me health insurance is boring, right? I don't know if they tell you that too. Boring, you know. It's pretty easy, short tail, money in, money out. Not much in the way of reserves, but I think it's anything but boring. I think it is quite an adventure. And some health funds have had more adventures than others. And there are a lot of war stories, and not all of them can be told yet, perhaps, but maybe with the fullness of times, more will come out. I think Brent knows a lot of war stories as well, and he's shared some of them over the years with us. And I think there's a lot to learn from looking back on history. It's not just dry and dull facts. I think they are living lessons for the present and the future for those that are involved in the management and operation of health funds and for the actuaries that advise them. So I think, I hope that today I'm going to get you thinking differently about thinking differently, actually, because thinking differently has sometimes historically got health funds into a lot of trouble. So I think rather than thinking differently, maybe thinking cautiously about thinking differently is a good thing. And I think thinking differently about tackling some of the problems of the seemingly more difficult times that might be ahead of us. We might get some opinions about what the next 10 years might hold, but certainly it seems there might be some more challenges ahead than the past 10 years, with the industry perhaps heading for membership decline. We've hit almost zero rate growth. And we've certainly had reducing government rebate, both in terms of the percentage and the means testing, with the freezing of the income thresholds for the next 3 or 4 years. I want to get you thinking differently about private health insurance premium increases and the consumer price index. I think That's an important thing that I've drilled into on the paper. And, you know, perhaps get you thinking differently about recent membership changes, the reasons and implications for those changes. So, yes, it's been 10 years since the paper that David and I wrote. David's up the back there. But it's been 10 years since the Private Health Insurance Act came in, and 10 years since the most recent round of risk equalisation changes. And back another 10 years, we had the Industry Commission report into private health insurance, which led to perhaps the biggest change we've seen in that period, which was lifetime health cover. And a number of you will be getting the Health Practice Committee Private Health Insurance newsletter. We've had almost 20 years of that. I think it's coming up for the 20th anniversary shortly. And the Risk Equalisation Quarterly Survey, those in the industry who participate in that will know how valuable that is to help them get more quick information about their net receipts or payments. So firstly, the regulatory environment. As I said, we've had the Private Health Insurance Act, and it came with a whole lot of supporting rules. Some of those have ceased to exist, and they've been moved into what is now the Private Health Insurance Prudential Supervision Act, which came about when regulatory responsibilities were moved from FIAC to APRA in 2015. We had those changes to the risk equalisation arrangements. The government rebate and Medicare levy surcharge has changed quite a number of times over the last 10 years in terms of the means testing has been introduced and the income thresholds have been adjusted and then frozen. And then, as I said, the regulatory supervision responsibilities move from FIAC to APRA. Now, the Private Health Insurance Act, I just picked out a few things I thought were of interest in the changes, because generally speaking, the idea was, this had developed since 1953, I think, Brent, the National Health Act had dealt with all of the aspects of Medicare, but it did private health insurance, and it was a bit all over the place. We had sections numbered with, three letters, section, B, C, D, and whatever they were, and then there's a schedule, and it was very complex for people to navigate, and it just built up over time. So I think it was a good thing to do, just to separate it out and simplify it. But some of the major changes, there was quite a change to the discounting regulations. So some of you have been in the industry for a while will know that there was quite prescriptive rules around discounts, and they were set out in circulars that the department issued from time to time, which perhaps there was some grayness about, whether they were legislation or regulation or what they were. But anyway, they were there with an intent, regulatory intent, that pre the Private Health Insurance Act, discounts were limited to 10%. But importantly, the idea was that you had to justify why you were giving a discount. So it had to be based on what you expected the administration savings to be from transacting business in that particular way. So it was talking about if people pay in advance, then there's a saving, or at least there's an interest accruing, so there might be a reason for a discount, or you might take money from an employer as a group contribution, and so there might be some savings in premium collection and administration. So there was an annual reporting regime of all these discount arrangements, and they had to be approved on an annual basis. All of that was swept away with the Private Health Insurance Act, and while the 12% cap remains, importantly there's no reporting, no linkage to or justification to the savings, and it now it used to include any commission that you paid, and that's excluded from it, and also an extra 12% can be paid as a maximum initial promotion. So the discounting changes have been freed up quite a lot in 2007, creating greater scope for aggregators because health funds weren't constrained on what they could pay. And the premium approval process, which gets much talked about, but it changed with the Private Health Insurance Act away from a test that it was not unreasonable or inequitable for contributors or adversely affect the financial stability of an insurer, the test now is the not contrary to the public interest. And the Minister for Health has said that they interpret this to mean the minimum necessary to ensure insurer solvency, support benefit outlays, meet prudential standards of capital adequacy and ensure affordability and value of private health insurance. Now, some of those things are potentially in conflict, and so the Minister of Health weighs those factors up in some way that is not explicitly disclosed to the private health insurers. Another change with the Private Health Insurance Act was broader health cover. And this is the idea that health funds were previously constrained from paying for things that were out of hospital treatment, and the industry was keen that they would be able to pay benefits for things that would perhaps prevent people from having a hospital stay, a hospital treatment. So there were two categories defined in the legislation that became allowable to pay benefits for and be able to be recouped from the risk equalisation arrangements: hospital substitute treatment and chronic disease management programs. I'm just showing the chart there of how much money has gone through those areas in the 10-year period. And, you know, it represents a fairly small amount, and it seems to have stabilised at something less than 1%. That might be something. People might want to discuss why it hasn't grown more than that over this period of time, since it seemed to be such a big issue at the time. Many of you will be familiar with the changes to the risk equalisation arrangements in 2007, changing from a fixed percentage of pooling for persons hospitalised who are age 65 and above to a more graduated set of factors, which are just shown in this chart. And the objective here was to really more evenly smooth out the retained costs across age bands, so that perhaps removing some of the incentive that might have been there for insurers to avoid persons of particular ages, or perhaps seeking out ones that who are just over the age 65. Now in theory, a health insurer shouldn't be worried about age. Now, of course, the issue of having lots of different products with different risk profiles and benefits means that age is still an important, or health status and age is still important. But in a system, a simple system like this, these percentages have improved the retained costs across age bands. And the government rebate and Medicare levy surcharge. Many of you will know the Medicare levy surcharge. This is the extra tax for those that don't have private health insurance. Was introduced in 1999, and the income level was $50,000, which was a high income back then. But then that wasn't increased at all until 2008, at which time it was biting fairly heavily on even graduate salaries. So it started to move from being a tax just on the wealthy that didn't buy private health insurance to a tax almost on average incomes. And so it was reset to $70,000, which represented a bit of a catch-up of the indexing that should have happened, and since then has been increased with inflation. However, it's now been frozen. The intention is for it not to change again until 2021. So there will be perhaps a bit of an increase in the proportion of the population that are caught by that measure. But it's also a freezing of this. The same income levels are used for the rebate means testing, and we have three income levels there: 90,000, 105,000, 140,000. So over 140,000 income single, no rebate at all. And they're doubled for couples, and there's a slight increase for those with dependent children as well. And we also have a tiering of the Medicare levy surcharge. So the 1% that started off initially, that they introduced the 1.25 and 1.5 for higher income levels. And the government rebate itself, which was, we used to be able to call it the 30% rebate, then they brought in the 35 and 40% rebates for older Australians, 65 to 69 and 70 above, and then they've started to reduce it as a bit of a proxy to capping the government's cost of the rebate to CPI. So I won't go through the mathematics there, a number of you know it, but a factor is calculated every year, the difference between the published average premium increase and the CPI, and that's used to progressively reduce all of those percentage rebates. So we're now down to about 26% rebate, and you know, it's falling by a bit less than a percent a year, depending on the relative interaction between premium increases and CPI. Membership. So we've had pretty good membership growth until the last couple of years. It's been above the rate of inflation. Sorry, not the rate of inflation, the rate of population growth. And, you know, with a spike there in 2007. And as I said before, that was when they reset the Medicare levy surcharge level of 50,000 hadn't been indexed for 11 years. So, you know, you can perhaps surmise that some of the growth that occurred up until 2007 was because more and more people were being picked up by this MLS threshold and decided that buying health insurance was going to be cheaper to them than paying the 1% extra Medicare levy surcharge. When that was reset, growth fell, and then so that's when the Medicare levy surcharge income threshold was indexed from 50,000 to 70,000. And then at this point here, that's when the rebate means testing came in. So some people lost their rebate or part of their rebate. And the rebate reduction, the 30% down to 26, started from about there. So you can see that government changes to the rebate and the MLS have coincided with changes in the growth rate of the number of persons covered for hospital cover. And now, growth rate is an anemic 0.2% per annum. So I think the latest figures that came out last week for the March quarter has it still at about 0.2 for the year to March 2017. Maybe there's some possible upside in the future from the freezing of the income thresholds for the MLS for a few more years, but we've still got the rebate reducing each year. Now, hospital cover by age group. The 25 to 39 age group, the pink one, is the group with the lowest level of cover. In fact, the 25 to 29 age group within that is the 5-year age band with the lowest level of private health insurance cover. And in some ways that makes sense. They're young, perhaps they have limited income, but certainly that's been at the lowest level. And you know, there've been a number of ideas over the years about how, whether it's possible and how we should encourage people in those younger age groups to take up private health insurance. And the group that's been growing the fastest has been the over 60s. There's been quite a growth from about 42% to about 54% over this 16-year period. I want to drill into that a little bit more, and you know, you're lucky you're here because this next couple of slides aren't in my paper, so you're getting a little bonus. And I want to talk about the membership impact of veteran gold cards. Now, those Australians that have served in conflicts overseas have and are over the age of 70 are eligible for what is called a Veterans Gold Card, and that gets them private health insurance like cover at the pleasure of the Commonwealth Government. So there is a sizeable group of older Australians who have served in conflicts, principally the Second World War, but also Vietnam and other conflicts. If they're over 70, they will have this gold card, and they really have no need to have private health insurance. The Department of Veteran Affairs suggests to those people that you don't need your private health insurance. This is going to give you everything that you need. And so what I've done is I've really said, well, what if we sort of put them on top of the private health insurance population? What would participation rates look like? Because this is a limited group of people, and they're going to age through, and they have aged through over time, and you can see what's happened here, that for the age 60 plus age group in 2000, in private health insurance we had 41.7% of that group covered, but then there was an extra 7.9% of this population who had this gold card. And this gold card can extend to war widows as well. So there was 7.9% extra. So you could say that coverage for the age 60 group wasn't 41.7%, it was 49.6%. Roll forward 16 years. Of course, this is getting a smaller and smaller group because they're dying off. But over here, the PHI participation rate observed was 53.7%. But if you add in the gold cards, you got 56.3%. So while there has been an increase, it's perhaps not as large an increase as apparent just by looking at the PHI statistics. And, you know, that's a one-off change. So going forward, we haven't got this gold card issue happening. And if you roll back in time, you know, it would have been a bigger group back a bit further. So it explains... the gold cards explains quite a bit of the recent growth in coverage for older persons. Of course, if you look at some more granular age groups, 80 to 89 and 90-plus... the gold cards make up a very, very large percentage of these age groups. Now here we've got PHI participation for 80 to 89 year olds of just over 30%, 34.9%. But another 24% have got PHI cover, like cover, as part of their gold card. Now, of course, they've all moved, many of them have died or moved into this next group. So when you look at PHI, it looks like we've gone from 34.9% of the population to 47.9%, but really we haven't. We've gone down from 58.9% to 52.3%. The age 91 is still a very large group here. It's been growing, but, you know, roll forward and that one will also decline. So over here, while it looks like we've only got about 35% participation rate, we've really got 58%. Now, that's enough on gold cards. Come to my insight session later this year and we'll talk a lot more about veterans' healthcare arrangements and gold cards and impacts on PHI, because I think it's a fascinating area of trying to unwind the PHI statistics, combine them with the gold card statistics, and see what that means. I mean, you know, the government's got some inbuilt budget savings, you know, they want to get the budget back in balance. Well, they've already saved, on my recollection, about $900 million just by, for, compared to what they were paying 10 years ago to now on expenditure on Department of Veterans Affairs in this area. And the private health insurance industry has picked up the tab effectively, if you look at it that way, because we're now insuring the current elderly who didn't go through these conflicts, and they've had to buy their own private health insurance. The financial performance of the industry, you look at that graph, it's a longer term graph, and you say the last 10 years have been pretty good. We've had pretty stable financial performance after some pretty woeful times in the 90s, and of course the one-off impacts, which you really should add these 2 years together, I think, of the introduction of lifetime health cover, where we had the first year where there was the growth and the claims followed the second year after that. Now, premium increases and the CPI. So in my paper, I've just pulled out a number of series over time. So we've got the private health insurance average increase, which is the red solid line. So this is the number published by the Department of Health and Ageing. And then I've tried to adjust that for the fact that that's after rate protection. So you can pull out the contributions in advance from the balance sheets and try and work out, you know, so there's an extra about 0.7 or 0.8 when you look at, well, what is the actual book rate, if you looked at it that way. Yeah, people can pay in advance, but really that's a one-time benefit. You've got to keep doing it. So really the underlying price increase is that line there. And then if you adjust for the fact that the rebate is now being slowly whittled away from 30% down to 26% in the last couple of years, then you've got these effective real increases of 7, 8, even 9% that, you know, if the consumer looks at their rate change letter, what's the difference between last year's price and this year's price that I have to pay? And this is the average that they must be seeing. Of course, there's a spread either side of that. And then comparing that to the CPI, the solid blue line, and then I pulled out the health CPI, that's a component of that, and then a component within that is the medical and hospital services CPI, which is higher again. Don't really know why it spiked there, but that'd be an interesting question to ask the ABS. There's not really any insight in the information. And there's also the green line, which is from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, increases in health dollars per person. Now, that's not private health insurance, that's the whole health spending across the economy. And in the table, I've just pulled out 10-year averages as well. So CPI is 2.6, health CPI is 4.6. But there's some other big movers in there over time too. Education and alcohol and tobacco. And alcohol and tobacco has got this incredible weight of 7%. I was stunned when I saw that. It's got a 7% weighting in the CPI, which is more than health. Remember, these are dollars that people spend out of their own pocket. So the health one doesn't include government spending. This is spending out of people's pocket. Now, when you look at the medical, inside that, the medical and hospital services component, that's been going up at 6.3% over 10 years. And I just pulled out another couple. Once again, those categories, similar or higher rates of growth, secondary education, tobacco, the weights there. Utilities, 7.4. Maybe you're not surprised at this because these are the things that get the headlines in the newspaper, you know, health costs, education costs, utility costs. And then there's some that are going down by quite a lot, you know. Audio-visual computing equipment, dropping by 12.2% per annum over a 10-year period. So, you know, all of our electronics are getting cheaper and cheaper. We probably don't see it because we're getting better and better quality. The CPI is quality adjusted. Now, what's in this medical and hospital services component? Consultants, consultations of physicians in general and specialist practice, and medical insurance. Now, medical insurance doesn't really, sounds a bit benign. They really mean health insurance because when you drill into it, the components that are in there, private health insurance premiums, are 57.7% of that part of the CPI. Or they're 37% of the health CPI of that number there, or they're about 2% of the overall CPI. So the takeaway here is that the ABS surveys all the prices and publishes a CPI index. 2% of the increase of the CPI basket is private health insurance premiums. So it doesn't, to me, seem to be a very good index to compare private health insurance to because it's already in there. Now, it's unknown exactly how the ABS, unknown to me exactly what prices the ABS look at, when what's in the basket. I do remember about 13 or 14 years ago, I got these phone calls from the ABS when I was at Medibank. And they want to know, what was Medibank's most popular product? Oh, why do you want to know? Oh, because, you know, it's part of the CPI calculation. So whether they were just polling one product, or just one popular product, or what they were doing, I don't know. And they did also ask, you know, has it changed in any way? You know, have you added more coverage? Have you taken things away? Have you changed the excess? Were they trying to do a quality adjustment as well? So I've actually put in a request with the ABS to try and find out a bit more about exactly what goes into that basket, which products, how they do it, because I think that would be very interesting to know. Now, I had this graph in our paper 10 years ago, and I've extended it. And some of you might be surprised to know we had 90 health insurers back in 1972. And that wasn't just because, you know, they all had to have a hospital and a medical registration separately. I've adjusted for that. And it wasn't because they had to be registered for in each state separately. I've adjusted for that. There were 90 separate named organisations who were running a health insurance fund. You know, and these categories, restricted and open, the two divisions that are recorded. So whether there's some restriction on who can join. You can see the big reduction over time has been in the open funds. It's reduced over that 45-year period. We've had an 80% reduction in the open non-profit insurers. That's quite a fall from here down to here. And then, of course, we've had an increase in the number of for-profit insurers. And the number of restricted not-for-profit insurers has reduced by 56%. So we're falling all the way through, and then we've had a blip up because we've had a couple of extra new health funds last year. Quite an event, actually. On the next slide, I've just got the number of new and ceased health insurers each year. And there's our three new health funds that we had last year: CBHS Corporate, Emergency Services Health, and Nurses and Midwives Health. And they're all associated with an existing health insurer. So it's interesting. We might see if there's any discussion about, you know, the strategy behind that. But you can see we only had three in the previous 25 years. And this one was health.com.au. And this one was NHBA, or One Medifund. And this one was Transition Benefits. So, and that one entered there and exited there because it was just a transitional arrangement for BHP. And in this year here, the three that exited were merger arrangements. So they're all for profit, the Bupa two funds and Manchester Unity. And this one was AHM. So we've lost four for-profit funds in this period, but there's still been quite a growth in the number of for-profit funds, as you saw on this graph here. So that's despite four funds exiting during this period here. Yeah, so there's the new entrants, and just a little bit about them. The most interesting one, of course, was health.com.au in 2012. So a little bit about health.com.au. It's the most significant new startup since Health Australia, more than 30 years before. And they still exist, but they are now owned by GMHBA. GMHBA bought them out in 2015. So their financial performance, you can see, I mean, you know, the first year was a very short partial year, and then their gross margin of 15% was sort of around about industry average or so, and then declined over a period of years with their rapid growth. Effectively, they ran out of capital, I think, is one way of putting it. There's probably more stories about this one than can be revealed, but what can be revealed is the purchase by GMHBA was part of a recapitalisation repayment of a $42 million loan from iSelect. iSelect had agreed to take some of the commission for distribution as payment over time, and so that loan was repaid as part of that, and iSelect did actually write some of their loans off as part of that. So we've had, you know, two significant new entrants. Health Australia a long time ago, have a look at their previous paper, they sort of lasted a similar amount of time, and health.com.au, which grew very rapidly to quite a sizable membership base, but then have been taken over by GMHBA. And we continue to have a number of funds that change status over time. So continuing trend from not-for-profit to for-profit. For smaller funds in this last 4 years or so, and from restricted to open, once again some smaller funds. And two of the four for-profit conversions were to do with acquisitions, and there's been a longer term trend towards restricted insurers going open. mergers and acquisitions is always the really interesting part in the table. There's the transactions that have occurred. I won't dwell on that. I've turned it into a bit of a table. I think this is perhaps a better way to look at all these numbers. That how much did the acquirers pay for goodwill? So if you want to measure it as a percentage of contribution income, it's generally 40 to 60% or so. Or if you want to measure it in terms of dollars per contributor, you know, it's generally $800 to $1,600. Of course, you know, these need to be adjusted for inflation over time. Some of these deals are 10 years or more old. This one, I just comment about the Medibank one. It's probably not a fair place to put that because the Medibank float included some non-PHI businesses, but I was not able to split out the value of those from the information publicly available in the information memorandum. So, you know, this is not just PHI business, whereas these other ones have been adjusted as best I can for just the PHI components. And you can see transport has been sold twice in this period, once to primary healthcare and then on sold to RT. So here's where I'd like to perhaps stop and get some questions and discussion going. I've got a number of discussion topics, but you can really talk about anything. The discounting rules, are they consistent with community rating, the changes that I explained, the freeing up of the discount rules? The consumer price index, so the measurement of PHI premiums in the medical and hospital services group, that PHI is already in the CPI. I'm not quite sure exactly how it's done, but it's a significant component. The premium approval process. What does this public interest test really mean? Have we got clarity about that? Membership trends, the impacts of the rebate and means testing reduction that I stepped through. Mergers and acquisitions, we had about one a year. Who's going to be next? Is it going to be as busy in the next 10 years as it has in the past? New entrants, the pros and cons of setting up a separate private health insurer, you know, as a subsidiary or associated entity to an existing health insurer. The restricted's moving to open. They're moving beyond their traditional base. We're going to see that continuing. And not-for-profit to for-profit has been realising of value outside of the health fund. So some of them have been through the sale of the whole health fund, and others, the health fund is part of a bigger group, and the health fund has been converted to for-profit, but the ownership still stays within the group. Okay, so.
Thank you. Thank you, Andrew. I remind you that this session is recorded, so if you have any questions or comments, please head up to the microphone, state your name and where you're from. And anyone? If not, I'll start.
Stuart. Stuart, sir.
Stuart, go for it.
Thanks, Andrew. Is that working? Andrew, as always, a really interesting and good coverage. On the discussion areas, I pick up the new entrant one, pros and cons of a separate insurer. I think it's really dangerous to have an industry where there are no new entrants. It just speaks of arthritis in the system and of uncompetitive barriers to entry. So I think that the health.com, even though there's lots of information that is commercial and in confidence and so on, I think it's worth everyone looking at what allowed that to happen. And it was the presence of the aggregators, and so a new insurer was not faced with impossible diseconomies of scale. The presence of the aggregators made that level of sales possible. As to why it got sold, I can't comment on that, but I would be very surprised if anyone who knew all the facts about that company, and I don't think anyone does, but I'd be really surprised if anyone who knew all the facts decided that it proved it's impossible to start up another health insurer. And so I hope that people will learn how to do it properly out of the health.com experience. And we have had some other health insurers start up as offshoots of existing insurers since then. That's a halfway house, but the health.com was good for having completely new capital invested in the industry and an attempt to make it work.
Mm. Yeah, well, obviously we have had those three new health funds. It'll be interesting to see how they pan out. You know, obviously I very much doubt they're going to be growing as quickly or as to a large size as health.com.au. And, you know, there must be a lot of lessons in the health.com.au experience, how we digest them. You know, we know that iSelect wrote off some of the money they were going to get for distribution, and we know that the investors in health.com.au effectively lost their investment. So that's not good. But there must have been a different way of running that would have been profitable for the investors. And looks like Gail's got something to add.
Not specifically about that. A couple of comments. I mean, I think wearing my cynical former public servant, former regulator hat, we need to understand that the premium approval process and the clarity of the public interest test is keeping it off the minister's back. So it's not actually a public interest test, it's a minister's interest test. Has not changed in any way since I lived here. It is about minimising the political fallback from a really tricky industry that often is in a difficult position to explain why the rates go up. People look at CPI numbers and they don't understand health CPI and everything else. So there's all sorts of politics around that. In terms of the new funds coming in, I'm the director of one of them, so I'm not going to make any comments about that, except that to look at the one that really failed, it was a growth issue. And that is an issue for all forms of insurance. If you grow too fast for your capital base, there were failures in fiat that I managed out of the industry for precisely that reason. So whilst I'm not privy to all of that, it happened after I left, I can still look at the trends, and they are no different from the Goldfields issue and the others, in that they did not understand the way in which the industry worked, they did not understand the core business, they did not really understand pricing. I don't want to see no new entrants to the industry either, but there has to be a broader understanding of this very political and tricky industry. The numbers are not as simple as people coming in from the outside think, and managing that growth. The internet is a really, really good way to go broke really, really quickly.
Yes, I do know that the people at health.com.au did read my Growing Pains paper, and you know, issues around growth, and there's a pipeline between when you get the money in and when the claims come along. You know, I mean, maybe they just wanted to grow and sell out quickly. Maybe it was a venture capital type thing, I don't know, to somebody that didn't quite understand what was coming down the pipeline, but maybe the claims arrived earlier than they thought. I don't know. I'm not privy to all that information.
Thank you. Sort of thinking about membership trends, I guess whether a customer is satisfied with their health insurance, I think ultimately comes down to the difference between what they expect and what they get. And I think a challenge is to be honest with people about the price increases they should expect and what drives them without completely scaring them off the product. Otherwise, we sort of go through this farce every year where even if you get a 4.5% increase, everyone's outraged and we have an inquiry and, you know, never again as a sort of sentiment. And I wonder if there's a challenge to the profession here in the absence of anyone else doing it, if there's an opportunity for us to be the people who can rationally and objectively explain why prices increase at the rate they do.
Mm. No, I agree. The clarity is important, and just trying to shy away from it or hide it is not going to solve the problem. Hence my digging into the CPI index a bit there to say, look, there are other parts of our lives where costs are going up at similar rates, and there are other parts where they're declining, and it's you know, we're spending more of our dollars on health and education and maybe alcohol, maybe tobacco, and less on technology. Sorry?
That was after they got their
health. Yeah, maybe it was. Yeah.
Can I remind you to state your name and your organisation, please?
Hayden Burner from Causeway. when we look back at a lot of the historical graphs in the industry and we see the big changes that came after some kind of government policy change, I'd be interested in thoughts about what could be the next major one and whether it's more likely to have a positive or negative impact on the industry.
Well, I think your guess is as good as mine. I mean, we've had 10 pretty good years. I mean, you know, I think we probably all agree on that. You know, you wouldn't wish to be back in the 90s in this environment. Brent can tell us some horror stories. I know, you know, health funds were having double-digit price increases every 6 months in some cases. That's, you know, before all the rate increases were brought together in April. And it's been underpinned by principally lifetime health cover, but also the surcharge and the rebate. Now, we've had a bit of a winding back, but it's not disaster yet. We're still, you know, now we're growing less than the rate of rate of population growth. But, you know, how much more withdrawing of those things would see us back in, heading towards crisis mode? And, you know, the government needs us and we need the government, I think, in this sector. It's not a subsidy to us, it's a subsidy to our consumers, but you know, there's and both sides of politics have a different view about how much to support us. So but the government's finances aren't good and we shouldn't be expecting any increases in support, I would have thought, for the next little while.
Brett?
Brent Walker, I was sort of pondering why there has been so few new health funds started, and it concerned me that the major insurers in Australia, you know, the big life insurers and general insurers, haven't wanted to venture into health. We did have one quite successful move into health by one of the major insurers, SGIC, in South Australia. And that was probably looked upon as a failure, but SGIC didn't fail because of its health insurance arm. Its health insurance arm was still quite successful. It failed because of purchases of offices in Collins Street at the wrong time instead of concentrating, you know, so it was investment losses which caused the group to fail. I'm just wondering, you know, maybe in time, with the number of actuaries around now that are working in health, some of them might end up migrating back into the life insurance or general insurance areas and use their knowledge to start up another health insurer, because I think that model will work. I really thought SGIC's model of, you know, somebody walking in going to a person at a counter and either transacting health insurance, general insurance or life insurance, all to the one person on the counter was quite a good model. And HCF have done the same sort of thing with life insurance and health insurance combined, you know, so their staff know how to transact life and health insurance at the same time. And I think that model's good, but so far nobody has bothered to think about it. But anyway, now that I've sown the seeds around here, maybe somebody might think of that model again. Cheers.
Do you want to respond to that or take that?
No, I think that would be great, Brent, if we could be the catalyst for starting some more health funds through our skills and experience.
Any more questions? Yeah. David?
David Watson. You've skirted around the issue of the portrayal of rate increases across the years. But putting a list of discussion areas like this is pretty blatant. You haven't put on this list the portrayal of the rate increases. So the Minister in particular in the last cycle published rate increases for each organisation, that's not new, and the industry average, that's not new. But as we know, and as you've just described, they're based on with rate protection.
Sure.
But they've done that year by year for the last 10 years. The journalists have gone out and done some compounding and have portrayed the rate increase, I think, in quite the wrong way. And I think that's an area that's going to come back and bite all of us in one way or another down the line. And I think should be on this list of discussion areas. Not that I have a solution for it right now.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you go to this chart here, you know, you can see the numbers that the department have published is this solid red line. I've said that if you take off rate protection, you get to that line, and if you take off, you know, the rebate coming away, it's that one. And that's partly government action. But this one, I don't know if you're suggesting, David, we should publish this, but, you know, this is what's going to be in people's letters, effectively. And yes, there has been a disconnect between the average they've published and what people actually see, even if everyone had the average rate increase, you know. But this is certainly just going to increase the level of criticism, saying, what, the rate increases are, you know, another 1% higher than we thought they were. You know, we need to win this argument about CPI not being the right base. You know, it never was. It never will be. Health CPI isn't it either. You know, it's our underlying benefit costs. And, you know, health funds try with different degrees of success or failure to explain that to their contributors each year. Okay, I just wanted to finish off with one slide. The ghosts of health insurance past are still with us. Just down the road in Swanston Street, we have the headquarters of the old headquarters of the Manchester Unity, started in 1932. They're now part of Australian Unity. And then in Sydney, in George Street, you probably can't make it out, but it says on the top there, MBF, established 1947. So they're still with us in a building, but not as an operating health fund. And out in Hawthorne, here in suburban Melbourne, a faded sign still there today in 2017, Agents for Health Australia, who finished up in 1990, so, or around about that time. So how long that vacant advertising space is going to stay like that, I don't know. Thank you.
I think that's all time for. Please help us thank Andrew for his really good paper.